Welcome to episode 277 of the Seahawkers podcast. I'm Brandon Schultz of the Military Seahawkers, and I'm joined by my good buddy and Montana Seahawker, Adam Emmert.
Hey, man. Good to be with you. I was curious, though, as to what step you were on in the steps of going through grief at this point. Like, how are you today?
I'm actually feeling pretty good. It's the middle of the week. I'm turning my corner. I'm looking ahead to the next opponent, and I feel like a lot of Seahawks fans have been going through that this week. It's really weird, and I think it only has to do with the fact that it was a loss to the Rams that I think is impacting Seahawks fans so hard, because it beat the Rams and even lose this game coming up against the Carolina Panthers, which they won't. I think coming out of a loss like that, people would go, oh, well, you know, we were 7-0, we beat the Rams, we weren't going to go 8-0, so a loss to the Panthers would be fine, but now we just can't lose to the Panthers, and we won't.
Right. And look, we'll get to that Panthers game coming up and we'll talk a little bit about that. But yeah, I think this is a bit of a bummer this week, having to deal with the scarring of losing to the catfish Rams yet again. And it's not even just this iteration of the Rams. Like, it's even going back to, you know, some of the Jeff Fisher teams that had no business beating us and making us look just terrible. Just those teams throwing up like difficult fights every time we played them and losing to them on the regular. It's just, for whatever reason, I mean, it just feels a little cursed. And like, it was time, it felt like, for us to kind of get our just due and like just mop them up and down the field in their half empty stadium. And somehow this team decided to come out sleepwalking and get utterly dominated, really. And it would have been one thing if we'd have lost in a last second field goal too. Like, the idea that they just went out there, like, threw their hat on the field and was like, hey, we're gonna win, and then get mowed over, like, that was really frustrating.
Well, and that kind of sounded like it was part of the sentiment coming out of the game, and I want to talk about that. But because the Seahawks lost, we have to have someone come out and take the blame for the loss, because, you know, before we point the finger at any players, we got to point the finger at ourselves as fans. And long live Decaf Metcalf at Seahawks Crazy on Twitter comes in, says, I need to come clean. I caused the loss to the Rams. I always wear my Seahawks tie to work on Fridays, but last week, Friday was my holiday party and I didn't wear it. My Hawker needs to be cleansed. Please, please absolve me of my sin. Go Hawks.
Oh, man. So I'm guessing you wore a holiday tie instead?
That's what it sounds like.
Here is exhibit number 4,432 as to why Christmas catfish sucks. I can't stand Christmas on 1,000 levels, and this is yet another example of why. You go to this mandated holiday party for your work that nobody really wants to go to, and if you do get a little too trashed, you might get fired because your boss will see you do something stupid. And on top of all of that, it makes it so that you don't wear your traditional Seahawks tie going to the company party. No, he ends up wearing the holiday tie and we lose to the Rams. Screw Christmas.
It's Christmas's fault. It's Seahawks Crazy fault. It's my fault. I've talked about it before, Adam, and I didn't even realize this until after we recorded following the game. I've had 3 beers this season on Sunday. And it apparently matters because I can have like a hard cider or something. It doesn't matter. But on the games that I've had a beer, the Seahawks have lost. And I did it again before the Rams game.
It's baffling to me that somehow having a beer has this large of effect on your life.
I don't know how.
I don't either.
This is concerned on multiple levels. 3 times, you know, once is a coincidence, twice is a trend, 3 times is a me problem. This is my problem.
This is your problem.
I have a drinking problem.
Yeah. And so get your poop in a group and you're cut off.
Well, a couple other things I do want to get into this game, aside from previewing the game coming up against the Panthers, I do want to look into the third down situation, because we've talked about it coming into the season. It was the one big question of who would be Russell Wilson's third down go-to guy this season. It seemed obvious it was going to be Tyler Lockett, but like any good clickbait headline, the answer might surprise you.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Do I guess now or are we getting into that later?
No, we'll get into it later.
Okay. All right. Cause I think I got a decent guess. I don't think it's that, surprising is going to be my official prediction.
But we're also going to get into the newest Patriots controversy, too, in the show.
Oh, I can't wait. What an exciting topic. Yay.
I am trying to tease exciting and interesting things, and you're pooping on it.
You're trying to tease poopable things. Like, that's what you're doing, and that's why they're getting pooped on. Nobody... If you care about this Patriots story, go find something to do with your life. There are other things. Hell, I would say even start doing meth. That's a better place to spend your time than worrying about whether or not a video camera grazed over the sideline as they're filming stuff. Whoopty freaking doodah day.
Oh, well, Adam's given us his take already, so maybe we won't be getting to that. But I do have some perspective on this that I think that even Adam will be interested to hear. And so we will get to that. But let's continue with this Rams game a little bit, because Joe Fan, after the game, he talked to Shaquille Griffin. And the tweet that Joe Fan put out on Twitter said, Shaquille Griffin wasn't afraid to call a spade a spade. He said the Seahawks were on a bit of a, quote, high horse, unquote, and needed a loss like this to bring them back to earth. He said he's hungry to get things corrected and get to Carolina.
Yeah, a lot to unpack from that. One is, if you just watch the game in any capacity whatsoever, you saw that right out of the gate. Like, they were flat as a pancake when they came out there. There was no energy. Every shot you saw, the sidelines, even when it was Russ trying to do his, like, hey, rah, rah, we're going to be okay stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like, that didn't even look like it had any juice to it. Like, everybody just looked like they were going to a funeral on our sideline from the word jump.
Yeah.
And you kind of saw some things snowball. The Rams come out and score on their first couple possessions. You know, then Myers ends up missing an extra point and, you know, all that stuff. And, like, you're just looking at it and you're like, it's just not our day. Like, this is just one of those days where everything goes against you. You're just not in the right headspace. It's just take your L and move on. And they were reading their own press clippings coming into this game. There's no doubt.
Well, and it had to be mostly on offense, because when you look at the final score, the Rams scoring 28 points. Would it surprise you to know that 28 points is the second lowest output by this Rams team against the Seahawks? The first time that they faced in week 5 in 2017 under Sean McVay, I think that was when the Rams scored. Was it that 16-10 game? Right. Anyway, that there was one lowest, and it was the first time that the two faced off since that time. And the Rams have, you know, gone on to blow up the league in terms of their offense, especially last year. But this year, you know, the first time we played, held the Rams to 29 points. And this week held them to 28 points. And if you would have told me going into this game that the Rams would score 28 points, I'd say, oh, I could count on our offense scoring 30, because that's what they've done in the past. And that's generally what it's taken for them to get the win this year.
Yeah, and this year they've been pretty consistent putting up points for the most part. I guess the part coming out of that game that was the most troubling and just weird to see, and the thing that I had the hardest time trying to figure out how it could have been, was watching our offensive line and defensive line really hold their own against, like, the Niners, who have a very good offensive line and a very good defensive line. Like, seeing those units, like, hold their own and stand toe to toe and be physical and, you know, look as if that they belong with any unit in the league, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then go against an offensive line for the Rams that's, you know, basically rookies and guys who have 1 foot out of the league, and they can't get anything going on a pass rush. Like, a couple stunts finally late in the game, you know, A-gap blitzes that happened late in the game because they were so freaking slow to adjust. And you started to get some pressure, but it's just really perplexing to see our offensive line get beat up as bad as it did and our defensive line get no push when they went against the Niners squad just 2 weeks, 3 weeks previous and showed that they belonged with anybody.
Sure. And a difference is that they have Aaron Donald on this defensive line for the Rams, but because they handled Nick Bosa, they handled, the guys that are on that defensive front for the 49ers, who... I don't know if I've seen a good explanation for it, but out of all the guys on the offensive line, you could only point to one guy, Dwayne Brown, who didn't give up any pressures in this game. Every single other one of those guys was giving up 1-2 sacks in the game, multiple pressures. And it was just a bad game all around for the offensive line, apart from Dwayne Brown.
I mean, maybe it makes you think that Wade Phillips is just a bad matchup for us.
I don't know how you can necessarily say it's a bad matchup for us when you look at the last few games against the Wade Phillips defense. They put up 30 earlier on in the season. They put up 31 points against them last season and in both games.
All right. It was just a clunker. I think that's what you have to do when you're trying to kind of flush this one out of your system is just be like, okay, were these legitimate systematic problems with this team, or was it just one of those days where it just wasn't your day? And again, it's your whole third loss on the season.
Yeah, I think one of the differences would be the secondary in this game. You had Jalen Ramsey on DK Metcalf. You had Troy Hill playing a pretty nice game, covering Tyler Lockett in this game. And that's maybe not something I can't remember saying Troy Hill's name out loud a whole lot before this game.
No, definitely not. Not a household name at corner, that's for sure. I mean, hell, he wasn't even the starter there at the beginning of this year.
Right.
But, you know, he did go out and play fine. I'm still waiting for Tyler Lockett to look like Tyler Lockett.
I feel like he's on his way back, though.
Yeah, every week he's going to be closer to being healthy than he was the week before. I mean, that's how that works, you know, when you're healing.
You had him get him involved early on with a little bubble screen. You had the one pass to him that, you know, should have been, was really close to being a first down and didn't get challenged, the spot on it. I don't know if the officials would have said that he gave himself up because his knee hit the ground, I think, before he would have crossed. But he had some plays in this game that made me start to think that Lockett's coming back.
Yeah, I would hope so. And again, like I said, it's just how like time works. So that makes sense to me. But
you can aggravate an injury again.
Sure, you can. But clearly he hasn't been re-aggravating the injury out there. I mean, we haven't seen him writhing on the ground, so that's not happening. So if that's not happening, then he's probably going to be getting better. But point being is like there's a few things in the first half that I look at and I say these are not systemic problems. These are just kind of fluky bad day problems, right? And I think the biggest thing was there were two drive extending catches that were dropped early in the game that took the offense off the field, whether it was Hollister with a drop and I can't remember. Malik Turner had the second one. And you catch those two balls, you keep drives alive, you keep the offense on the field, maybe you get some points too to put a little more pressure on the Rams. You take them out of their rhythm, you allow our defense to rest a little bit, and then also have time to adjust, because the defense did finally adjust and they kind of held them to not very many points going down the stretch. Now, if they were able to make those adjustments earlier, then maybe the Rams only score 17. And those two possessions that you could have converted, you get another 14 points out of. Like, that changes the whole game. It takes the momentum out of the Rams' hands a little bit. And I think that was the biggest problem in the game was those two drops.
It took a lot of energy out of the team, and that was something that was missing. And I think we've covered just the amount of energy that it seemed like the team was lacking in this game. So what does it mean for the Seahawks and their playoff chances moving forward? It really doesn't impact it a whole lot. You know, the Seahawks can still go 3-0, finish 13-3. If they tie with New Orleans, and they would need a Green Bay tie at 13-3. If there's a three-way tie, the Seahawks would have the number one seed. And I think New Orleans would get the number two based on that three-way tie. Or, you know, if New Orleans loses a game down the stretch, they could do it too. And I hear a lot of people say that, oh yeah, well, this team's not going to beat San Francisco in week 17. Why would people assume that Seattle has no chance to beat the 49ers in week 17 at this point?
Well, it's a lot of the 49ers going out the last few games on the road and playing heavyweights and losing closely to Baltimore. And then, you know, basically squeaking one out against New Orleans as well. And everybody thinks that, whoa, well, they're a juggernaut now. I mean, that's just how the media cycle goes. And so, of course, they don't feel like the Seahawks have a chance at home against the 49ers, which is a ridiculous thought. But you know, as far as the playoffs go, I mean, yeah, I think we have a very strong chance of winning these next two games and setting up that week 17 game to be for the two seed or the one seed, you know, just depending. I know you said there's a three-way tie. Like, I'm not counting on any of that BS. Like, let's talk about what we actually control. Like, sure. if we go out there, Saints don't lose a game, Niners don't lose a game until we see them in week 17, and we beat the Niners, we're the 2 seed. That's how it works.
Well, unless the Packers would have to lose a game too for us to be the 2 seed. Otherwise, we'd be the 1.
You get off of that. That's stupid. Green Bay is going to lose another game.
That's a possibility. Okay. All right. Maybe the 2 seed is the most. The 2 seed. Let's just say the 2 seed is the most likely.
Okay. 2 seed is the most likely if the team wins out. What's most likely is we're going to end up being the 5 seed at this point.
So you're saying the most likely outcome is that the Seahawks probably lose in week 17.
I didn't say it was in week 17.
You're just one of the 3.
Just odds are, you know, I mean, sure. it's just how it works. Now, do I think they're going to, you know, be 1-2 going down the stretch or 2-1? No, I really think that they have an excellent opportunity to be 3-0. I'm just saying, if you're going to give it worst case scenario thought process, okay?
Yeah.
The worst case scenario thought process is you're going to be a 5 seed and you're going to be playing an abysmal NFC East team. So whoop-de-doo. Like, I don't care that much. I just would like the bye. If we don't get the bye, fine. We're still in the playoffs and we'll see the Niners again. It's going to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think just most Seahawks fans, they would like to have a home playoff game and a bye.
I get it. Me too. Because
that is the most, happen. If you're talking Super Bowl probability, that's the most likely way to get to a Super Bowl.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Super Bowl when we get there.
Yeah. After week 17, it's probably a good time. To see how we're feeling about that.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we got a ways to go yet. I'm not talking Super Bowl yet. We're on to Carolina.
On to Carolina and the 5-8 Panthers, ranked third place in the NFC South this year, down a 5-game losing streak. Fired their head coach, Ron Rivera. This is a Panthers team that's really not in a very good place right now.
Yeah, they just let go of their longtime coach, no doubt about it, and probably... You know, him and Dom Capers, right? Probably the two coaches in Carolina Panthers history that have had the biggest impact. You know, both solid coaches, but it's funny to kind of go over a lot of the stories for the Panthers here this last week. I mean, man, they're still in mourning about this. Like, they're in rough shape. And then they roll into Atlanta with this Ron Rivera hangover and get, you know, mollywomped 40-20 by the Falcons. I mean, they're in a tough spot right now. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, that game against the Falcons, you know, talk about a team that just didn't look like they wanted to be on the field. I mean, they played the Skins the week before. That game didn't look all that great. It started out better, and I think because it was at home, but on the road against the Falcons, just the defense didn't look like they really wanted to play. Luke Kuechly, he's probably the only one that's actually out there looking like he's making some plays still, and even he's having kind of a down year this year. The interesting thing to me was looking at the Panthers and how much they've changed from earlier on the season when Christian McCaffrey is being talked as a potential MVP candidate. And now you look at the fact that they pass, and maybe it has to do with the fact that they're playing from behind so often, but where we see a pretty close split from pass plays to run plays for the Seahawks, 53% to 46%, the Carolina Panthers with Christian McCaffrey are only running the ball 36% of the time.
Yeah, and that's not as surprising as you might think, because a lot of what Christian McCaffrey does is catches out of the backfield.
That's true.
I mean, he's a de facto extra receiver. So, I mean, I guess the split doesn't surprise me so much. The Kyle Allen regression, that hasn't surprised me so much either. He looked terrible against Atlanta and is having a hard time against, you know, the cover three, which is, guess what? Our defense.
Right.
Like, that's what he faced last weekend and had a really difficult time against. I would think that this is a great matchup for Ken Norton coming in, and we should see a return of a defense that looks as if they can go toe-to-toe with anybody.
Yeah, Christian McCaffrey definitely involved in the passing game, even in these last 5 straight losses of theirs. 11 catches against the Falcons 4 weeks ago for 121 yards. Against the Saints, 9 catches, 69 yards. 7 catches, 58 against the Skins, and last week, 11 catches, 82. So that's going to be Kyle Allen's favorite target in this game.
Oh, without question. And Greg Olsen might be back. It sounds like he was practicing, and he's always been somebody that's been a thorn in our side. So that's something to keep an eye on.
DJ Moore's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then I look at the defense and there's names on that defense. Like, you know, whether it's Gerald McCoy or Shaq Thompson or Luke Kuechly, and they've got some players back there. Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's more talent on this team than their record indicates. And it's enough to make me worry just a bit, just a bit. And we could very well go in there and do the same stupid crap that we do when we play against lesser opponents. Go in there and just play down to their level, be in a shootout, and Russell Wilson has to pull it out in the end. And it could be a one score game for no reason.
The thing is it wouldn't surprise me either, just because the way this team does operate, even on the road, well, pretty much whether it's home or on the road for the entire season. One guy, I know you mentioned Gerald McCoy. He's number two on the team with pressures. He has 7 sacks on the season. The guy who's leading the team, Mario Addison, their edge rusher, 42 pressures, 11 sacks this year. So look out for him.
You know, some names to think about, and they do have players.
Bruce Irvin. I didn't even know Bruce Irvin was still in the league. He's on the Carolina Panthers.
I remember him signing there this offseason and all of us feeling a little betrayed, but that's okay. So it's our revenge game on Bruce Irvin, I guess.
Good. I don't know if I need revenge on Bruce Irvin, but
that's what I'm saying. It feels like the weakest revenge game ever.
I hope the Seahawks can find a way to get pumped up for it.
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, this Rams thing should have been predictable, because this is what this team does every year. Like, we look like we're in prime position to get the one seed, do all that stuff, and then like lose a stupid game down the stretch. And you're just like, oh, if we would have just won that one, this would have been a lot easier. You wouldn't have to do all these things to get to where we want to go. And they just don't perform unless their backs are against the wall. And right now it is. Like, if they want that first round bye, your back's against the wall. The only thing that scares me is their back isn't against the wall of just getting in the playoffs. So like that scares me a little bit.
Because looking at the percentages, it's a 98% chance for them to get in the playoffs. They could essentially lose out the next 3 games and probably still get in the playoffs.
Correct. Yes, that's exactly right. So that's something to think about, too, I guess.
I don't like thinking about that.
Well, I'm just saying the end of the world scenario, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Panthers should be the perfect team as a get right game for. Russell Wilson has a great record down there in Carolina. I don't know what it is off the top of my head. I just know he always wins when he goes down there, and I like that a lot.
Well, the one loss would be the playoff loss, 31-24 in that 2015 season.
Mm-hmm.
So Russell Wilson 4-1 when going on the road and taking on the Panthers.
I like my odds that way, no doubt about it. I think the one thing that does hurt a little bit is the idea that Rashad Penny is out for the year. That is really difficult to swallow. And it does make the idea of going anywhere in the playoffs a lot harder.
I'm having a hard time really getting behind this idea that Rashad Penny, losing him, is really going to hurt the team, because it was. Yes, he absolutely added something that we haven't seen this team have, mm-hmm. You know, up until what, week 10, 11, 12, when we started to get more production out of Penny.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until this point in the season that, I mean, earlier on in the season, we were talking about, you know, why not trade him, because you can get a 3rd-round pick from the Lions or something.
Well, I look at it from a different perspective, and it's not the idea of what he was doing within the offense right now that I think was so invaluable. That's not the thing that I worry about. That's not the part that I'm bummed out about that we're missing with Penny going out for the year. My problem is for that potential Chris Carson injury. As we go forward, you know, through the playoffs and that sort of thing, we don't now have that insurance policy of Rashad Penny to go ahead and just turn around and hand the ball off to.
Yeah, CJ Procise, we saw him in the game a couple times, and he fumbled the exchange with Russell Wilson and didn't get a hold. I think he had 2 yards on his one actual carry. So you worry about that. Travis Homer is kind of the unknown. We've seen him have the one carry on the fake punt, and we've seen his toughness in the preseason.
Yeah. He's a very average running back.
Well, I would think getting a guy in the 6th round, and we've seen some toughness on some runs in now that he's taken kickoff returns, I suppose.
Sure. Look, I wouldn't be, I don't think we're in dire straits if we have to turn to Travis Homer in the sense of he can't play. I mean, he can play. He can be serviceable, but he's not a difference maker in the run game like Chris Carson is, or even Rashad Penny is getting to the outside.
Yeah.
So maybe CJ Procise can come alive a little bit here. I mean, when Russ wants to keep the ball, let him keep the ball. CJ Procise. It's not always yours.
Yeah.
That was such a bummer, too. That was a big play right there. The edge was wide open.
Yeah.
And Russ wanted to keep the ball.
Well, I think Russ has been keeping the ball so little lately It just seems like a de facto idea that he's going to hand the ball off. And yeah, that was disappointing.
Do they communicate on that, or is it just kind of they're both reading the same thing?
I mean, kind of a read and a feel of the football.
Yeah, I think they need to do something different. Like when Russ wants to take it.
Yeah.
Like since his head's right next to the running back's head while they're doing that.
Yeah.
He should just be like, mine.
Yeah, like an outfielder in baseball.
Yeah, just mine. Yeah. And then you know.
I like that idea. There should be some communication there is what you're saying.
Yeah, with the mesh point and all that and the read option. But
mesh point.
Yeah. But, you know, in pro size, again, he could be a guy that comes in and gives us a little something. I mean, he does have talent.
Yeah.
My big, you know, concern with Penny's injury is just the idea with this. We don't have him as a backup plan to a Chris Carson injury going forward, which, you know, knock on all the wood, hopefully we don't have now.
Yeah. And I can see that especially from that perspective, because running game is so important for this team. And we know Russell Wilson. Yeah, he can distribute the football for sure. But if guys aren't going to catch it, we've seen that be a problem this year as well. It kind of takes me into what I've been looking at with the third down conversions.
Okay.
Historically, I went back all the way to the beginning of Russell Wilson's career just to kind of get an idea of when that, because we know that Doug Baldwin for so long became that go-to guy on third down, and it played out the way, you know, just looking at it over the years. But it was Sidney Rice who was his first third down guy back in 2012. He had 27 targets, 15 receptions, and 14 of those 15 receptions went for a first down. So pretty good percentage there. Golden Tate was the next one, 16 first down conversions on third down. And then the next 4 years all belonged to Doug Baldwin with 36 targets, 32 targets, 30 and 30 in 2016 and 2017.
Yeah.
Yeah, not shocking.
No, I don't have a lot to add to that. Like, yep, okay, cool.
And then last year, 2018, Tyler Lockett, because of Doug Baldwin's injury, he took over. And 24 targets, 13 of his 16 catches going for first downs.
Mm-hmm.
Through 14 weeks of this season, where would you guess the targets have gone? Majority of targets on third down.
Oh, so we're going majority of targets. Okay, so number of targets, not efficiency.
Yeah, let's go. Well, we can talk about both. I have both efficiency and number of targets.
Okay, efficiency is Josh Gordon, and I know that's got to be it. And as far as number of targets, I'm going to go with Chris Carson.
Number of targets is not Chris Carson, and it's not even close.
Okay.
He's not even on my list.
All right. Well, I went out of the box because you act like you've got something here that's like basically there was a second shooter on the grassy knoll. I thought this was going to be like groundbreaking. So if I had another guess, then I don't know. DK.
DK Metcalf has been targeted on third down 27 times. Tyler Lockett is the next closest with 16.
Okay.
Efficiency numbers, though, only 11 of those 27 targets have resulted in first downs. You know, of those 27 targets, only 14 have been receptions. So of the actual catches, 11 of 14, yeah. Tyler Lockett, of his 12 catches, 7 of 12 have gone for a first down.
Right.
But in terms of efficiency, yeah, there's two guys, Josh Gordon and Jerron Brown. And I give the edge to Josh Gordon because 6 targets on third down, 5 receptions, all 5 for first downs.
Yeah, that's why when you were teasing who's the big third down guy now for the Seattle Seahawks, I was like, well, it's Josh Gordon, dummy.
He's been there for all of 3 weeks, and yeah, he's already making his presence known in that department. Jerron Brown, 12 targets, and like I said, 7 receptions, all of them for first downs. A couple of he had the most touchdowns, too, on third down receptions. So the one guy that was disappointing to see on this list, David Moore, 11 targets, just 3 first downs.
Yeah, I think we're kind of starting to see the ceiling of David Moore's game as a wide receiver. You know, and the fact that he's gotten this far as like a practice squad guy and really just work his way up the roster to be a guy who earns significant minutes and play the wide receiver position, hats off to him, man. Like, that, what a great story to get that far. But as far as the way that he fits into this offense right now, his skill set and everything, all he is a contested catch receiver right now, and he's not making many of those.
No, it's disappointing. But like you said, for a guy who is a 7th round pick, the same draft as Chris Carson. Now, Chris Carson has done quite a bit more with his seventh round status, but
right,
you know, for two guys picked in the seventh round that you don't expect anything from, that's a pretty incredible draft to come out with two guys that have contributed in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely nothing to scoff at. I mean, if you said you could get that sort of production out of all your seventh rounders, you'd do it in a heartbeat.
So DK Metcalf has taken over as Russell Wilson's go-to guy on third down, apparently, with the 27 targets, still three games left to go. And he's having a pretty incredible rookie season. I've compared his rookie season with the going back to 2010 and the rookie receivers. He's at number 24 with three games to go of all the receivers that came out over the last 10 years in terms of the production that he's put on the field in his rookie season.
Yeah, he's having a good year. I mean, we've talked about this a few times on the podcast now. And I mean, those were the expectations, or the highest of expectations, right? What he's doing now. And we both agreed in the preseason, like if he had about half of that, it'd be a successful year. And he's doing all of it. So I think you'd have to say it's a very successful year, and good for DK. Lots of things still work out in his game, and I'm excited to have him on my team. I just don't know how many times on the podcast we can have a DK Metcalf is having a good rookie season conversation.
I just want to make sure DK gets his credit. I know you don't want to talk about it over and over every week and ad nauseum.
Look, it's fine. If we want to have a new segment called Decaf Metcalf, you know, the Decaf Metcalf segment, and we just sit here and talk glowingly about his rookie receiving numbers and compare them to other rookie receivers throughout the history of the NFL, and you want to do that week in and week out, we can get a theme song for it. We can do the whole thing, bud.
Good.
That's what you want to do.
I want to hear from a listener with a Decaf Metcalf theme song. Although the Decaf Metcalf, I do like that he came out with his own coffee this past week, apparently.
Yeah, keep
like,
getting them checks, buddy. Yeah.
And but I feel like the Decaf version is like the lesser version.
Yeah, you have a weird aversion to this that I don't understand at all, because you were showing me some graphics you had made up and everything, and you changed it to full calf Metcalf, which I guess now I understand where you're coming from. But you understand that the joke of it is that Testator got the name wrong, and DK sounds like Decaf, right?
Oh, I understand, but I think he got his name wrong on an unsuccessful play, if I remember right.
It was a contested play. I'll give it that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like he did anything wrong.
Well, it wasn't a touchdown or anything. If Testator would have done it on like some explosive play, then I feel like Decaf Metcalf would be a positive version of DK.
That's a weird qualifier to put on it. I don't understand that at all. It just it is what it is.
Okay, my DK mind works
sounds
weird.
Like DK.
What can I say?
Yeah. Yeah, you spent a lot of time thinking about this, too. You've been on a DK Metcalf, like, bender this week. Like, are you okay? Do we need to get a grease board out of your basement, like, Beautiful Mind style? Are you writing on the windows right now? And is it all, like,
when
Metcalf
I went into
puns?
The third down stuff, I did not expect DK Metcalf to come out on top. That was not part of my grease board work. I wanted to know who the third down guy was this year for Russell Wilson, and it turned out to be DK.
Okay. Cool. So let's take his nickname and change it to something else that you find more palatable then. Let's do that.
Okay.
And have a weekly segment. Decaf Metcalf.
Decaf coffee is a weaker coffee than regular caffeinated coffee.
Wrong. You don't know catfish about coffee. And I know this because you don't drink it. Number one, it doesn't taste weaker or stronger depending on how much caffeine is in the coffee, right? It's the roast of the beans, number one. And number two, decaf has a place in the world if you love to drink coffee as I do, like say on a road trip and it's like 6 p.m. and you're going to be hitting a hotel in about 3 hours, but you'd like a warm drink munchie as you drive down the road. Decaf coffee, amazing. Like it has its place. It's a very valuable commodity. And for you to come out here and poo-poo decaf, I don't know, man.
I think it's time to move on.
You think? I think we found the end of that one. Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say about this Carolina game coming up?
This damn well better be a win. That's the last thing I have to say about this Panthers game. Like it's a needed win. We have to have this. Go Hawks.
Kyle Allen is not good. We cannot allow him to look like Joe Montana.
or Jared Goff from last week. Ugh.
I want to say the Carolina Panthers offensive line isn't good, but I wanted to say that about the Rams offensive line, and I was proven wrong last week.
No, they're not good. Somehow they were good that week.
Yeah. That's what can make the difference between Kyle Allen being okay, having a clean pocket to throw from, and being normal Kyle Allen.
Yeah. Now, is Ziggy going to play in this next game?
I don't even see him on the injury report this week.
Okay, cool. Look, I think what I've come to figure out about our pass rush is that if we're going to rush with four dudes, that the only time that we're able to get pressure with four dudes is when we have Jaren Reed, Ziggy, Clowney, and Keem out there at the same time. And if you have any one of those four not out there, we're in trouble. Like, they just can't do it. But collectively, they can get it done, but they need all four of them.
Keem was only on the field for 9 plays against the Rams.
Right. And once he did start getting out on the field, it changed things a little bit, didn't it?
2 of those 9 plays were Jared Goff interceptions.
Correct.
How did they not play him more?
I don't know. I mean, I get it. I get it in the sense that you can't have him out there on rundowns a ton just because he is so light. And that would be problematic. I mean, a team would scheme against that if you were playing him more snaps. But in obvious passing situations or even borderline passing situations, get him out there more. We need his motor.
Well, I remember back to the Philly game where he was blowing up the handoff between Goff and Sanders and making a big play. So having him out there on running downs could be valuable, too. Now,
well, you're going to get one of those types of plays in the run game for every 6 where a tight end and a tackle double team him and
put him on the ground.
And just mush him, right? So, I mean, it is what it is. And you can't rely on Keem setting the edge, play in and play out. Hell, Cody Barton couldn't even set the edge in this last game.
Well, we mentioned the Rashad Penny injury. One other injury I think we should mention is the fact that Nico Thorpe went on to IR. And I wonder if just a player that means that much within the locker room, if that brings down the energy going into a game.
If it does, we're reaching.
I'm reaching at this point. I just want to know.
Well, look, I mean, did Nico Thorpe die or did he just go on IR?
Yeah, he did not die. I can confirm Nico Thorpe is alive.
Okay, so he can still be around the team. It's not like they're losing their buddy forever.
Yeah.
He's still a conscious human being. So, I don't think that had that big of a deal to do with it.
I want to know why their energy was so low. That's all I want to know.
Voodoo.
Let's get to the second half of the show.
Sounds good.
Getting into the second half of the show, and speaking of Nico Thorpe, the Seahawks made a roster move on Wednesday, placing Thorpe on injured reserve, and Ryan Neal signed off the practice squad, promoted to the active roster.
It's a dude with 2 first names.
And he's a corner. I wonder if he can play nickel.
Doesn't matter. We're not going to do it.
Pete Carroll does seem to have an aversion toward playing nickel defense this year.
Yeah, I think he's trying something. I think he's trying to prove a point of some kind to the league, and it's almost going well.
Every time he's asked about it, though, he's like, I look at the numbers, and our numbers are pretty good with having all these guys on the field right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, the number that matters the most is wins versus losses, 10-3, and well, he's not wrong. They look pretty good.
Hard to argue with that. Yeah, the numbers he points to, I think he's saying that the opponents are averaging, 6 yards or something, and he'll take that.
Yeah, I know. It's just hard to watch your defense get carved up like they did against that stupid scheme in the Rams, you know, for the millionth freaking time.
Another move they make is bringing Xavier Turner back to the practice squad and as some running back depth.
Okay.
All of these running backs that they had as potential depth, Mike Davis, I think he's with Carolina now. Bo Scarborough, who was with the team in the preseason, mm-hmm. he's with Detroit, mm-hmm. along with J.D. McKissic. People snatching up all our running back cast-offs.
True. I actually was really hoping we'd keep Scarborough, but I mean, I know how the roster broke down and they kept a lot more receivers and all that stuff. So, I mean, I guess it was maybe inevitable, but yeah, a lot of the former backups for the Seahawks with the running back position having a an impact around the league. In a way, it makes me feel good. I mean, I just know that we can find more depth there as we go. Like Xavier Turner might be a lot better than either of us ever really even know.
Let's welcome some new members of the flock.
Okay, maybe that'll make me feel better today.
A lot of new 12-12ers coming in this past week, including Amy Holmes in a 12-12. Welcome to the flock to Amy.
Yeah, welcome, Amy. We needed some fresh blood in the Ring of Honor just to maybe help boost all our spirits. So glad Amy's there.
Amy came in. Marcus came in at 12-12. Says, "G'day, guys. Just wanted to thank you for helping out an Aussie Hawks fan. Whilst hard to watch the games on my phone at work while trying to pretend I'm working, your podcasts keep the momentum going and give me insight an ignorant Aussie might otherwise miss. Keep it up and go Hawks."
Hey, man, we'll do our best. And I appreciate anybody who is a fan from the opposite side of the globe and they like put in the type of effort to be able to still watch the games. Like, the idea he's got to sneak watch it while he's working. Like, that's real dedication there.
Yeah, because it's, what is it, Monday morning usually when the games are on over there?
I don't know. Maybe. I'm really bad at time zone things.
Well, I know that Australia lives in the future, so they usually know the outcomes of the games before we find out.
Really?
Because it's the next day.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. That's how I keep it straight in my head.
Okay. that sounds like it's a really good way to do it. People are living in the future.
Yeah, Australia.
In the land down under. Yeah.
Preston Morrow in at 12-12. Welcome to the flock, Preston. He says, "Love the catfish show. Go Hawks."
Hey, man. Appreciate that.
Need to get Preston in the Ring of Honor. Let us know. I know some people have trouble with the invite and getting in there. So Preston needs to email me if gohawks@seahawkerspodcast.com if you have any trouble.
Well, yeah, we need him. We need him in there.
I know.
We need all our guys healthy.
David Van Cleve, a healthy member that shows up every week. He put in a little extra for the holidays this week. David says, "Stupid PayPal billing an old account, even after repeated confirmation that following month would come out of the right account. Cancel the offending auto payment and set up a new one. Merry Christmas to you. Enjoy the extra donation this month. Also,
catfish,
the Rams and the 49ers. Go Hawks."
See, well, that's what we all know. David has his priorities in the right spot. He knows all the right things to talk about, including auto pays and updates and things like that. Like, it's maddening. It's maddening. And I know he's doing his best, but the system's out there to just try to take you down. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. Thanks to David, though, coming in. Seahawkerspodcast.com/support. Another one coming in via PayPal. Jason in Portland says, "What a catfish Monday hangover." Here's the thing, though. This loss is not unlike Adam and Brandon's guilt trip that, quote unquote, encouraged me to up my monthly contribution from $1 to $3. I felt like hot catfish being in the flock week by week, knowing that I was supporting the show. But I started getting a little too comfortable and slowly got closer and closer to, dare I say it, being just as good at life as Skip Bayless. This feeling, though, inspired me to step up my supporter game in the same way that this loss will up our game to the next level just at the right time. So thank you, catfish Rams. Thank you, Adam and Brandon's guilt trip. Thank you, Quandre Diggs. And thank you, new job that allows me to finish my PhD while working full time to pay for this new baby due in February and upping my contribution to the show. Go Hawks. But also come back, Hawks, since you were supposed to play a game Sunday night. Where were you? And go Adam, and go Brandon.
That's a great email.
And Jason came in with 36, $3 a month for the 12 months. Appreciate it, Jason.
That's awesome. Appreciate it a ton, Jason. And congratulations on about to become a papa. That's always cool. And, probably a good idea to get a PhD to pay for those kids. They tend to be financial drains, even, for as much love as they give you. Like, they still suck a lot of money out of the old bank account. It's just how that works.
Yeah, diapers cost money, and as well as many other things. Baby food, apparently. And yeah, there's just stuff that you don't even think about.
They just do that. Bail. stuff like that.
Yeah, you know what? You should start putting some bail money away now that with the age your little one's getting up to.
Yeah, she's being 16, closer to 17 at this point. Yeah. Like, I feel like bail is in her future. Like, it could be. And not because she's a bad kid. She's actually a really good kid. Like, but you tend to make
kids. You let the bad kids stay in jail.
Yeah, let them stew for a bit. Yeah. Yeah. But, she's probably going to make one really poor choice as far as being around somebody else who's doing something stupid and goes to jail by proxy, because that's the only way I've ever gone to jail. And So yeah, I'm just going to be, I'm going to be ready for that.
And just let her know it'll come out of her college fund.
Well, duh. So yeah, there's a little pro tip for all of you parents out there who have kids that are coming up and about to be teenagers. Start setting aside bail money now. There you go.
Hey, well, we're giving away congrats to new kiddos. I talked to Sean Widmer, Slim from Spokane, the radio station that we went in and did the Dick Allen Slim
really?
Show with. Yeah, he did the Rams post-game recap with me on field goals this week.
Oh, killer. Okay.
And he has a new baby girl. And he was telling me about just how much time now he's spending explaining the game of football to, you know, a newborn and how much fun is.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I mean, it's fun when you get like this kind of blank mold or a lump of clay that you get to mold into whatever you want.
Yeah.
So, yeah, mold her into a believer in a running first football team. Like, yeah.
And, you know, just a fan of Russell Wilson. Now, what better quarterback can we have to teach our young girls to say, this is the type of guy that that you want to look for in life?
You know, it's funny when Kaepernick was at the peak of his popularity with the 49ers and that rivalry was going on between Russ and I was like, okay, like here's two guys. And this is before he stood up for all the social stuff and whatever. And take whatever you want on that. But just he was a Niner and like, you know, he's kind of doofy. And like, you know, he'd wear kind of like dopey looking clothes to award shows and stuff. And Russ would show up in like a nice tie and say all the right things. You know, I'm like, yeah, who are you choosing?
See, now you should be drawing the comparison, Adam, between Russell Wilson and Baker Mayfield, a guy who shows up to a press conference looking like a hobo, you know, throwing his medical staff under the bus.
He lives in the stadium.
Does he?
Yeah, haven't you seen? Like, he's having breakfast with the janitor and, like, mowing the lawn, looking for fire detectors and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. On the commercial.
No, that's where he lives now. It's on TV, Brandon. It must be true.
It's too bad they don't have working showers and razors, though, in the stadium for him.
Yeah. Well, you'd think they could afford it as an organization, being that he's still on his rookie deal, but I guess not.
Apparently not. Moving on to some more email. Front-running 49ers fan. Although that's kind of redundant, isn't it, now that I say that out loud? But Jason is in. Says, Adam and Brandon. This is Jason, the 49ers fan. Yes, I'm still listening. I enjoyed the games today tremendously.
No way.
I listened to the last episode of the pod, and I couldn't help but grab a paper and pen, write down some of Adam's quotes.
Okay.
Adam, quote, boo-hoo, Niners, you're not in first place anymore. Adam, quote, enjoy your loss to the Saints. Adam, quote, we probably won't see you past week 17.
Yeah.
Adam knocks Jimmy G, but he had a great season and continues to improve. Adam may be correct that the Seahawks won't see the Niners after week 17. The Seahawks may not make it deep enough into the playoffs to face them. I look forward to the week 17 game, unless the Niners already have the division wrapped up. I hope you both are well. Go Niners. Adam, just to clarify, that would be the first place 49ers. Jason.
Actually, enjoyed that email very much. Appreciate you, Jason, man. That's some funny stuff. Well, the one thing I am very concerned about, though, and I'm dead serious about this. I really hope that Jason has like a service in his area. Like, we have a business here. It's called Norco. They deliver like different products to your home. Like, a lot of it's for like older folks, like who maybe need some extra oxygen or things like that, because he's going to need some extra oxygen sitting way up there on that high horse, because the air is getting real thin up there. I can tell. And the reason why I can tell is he's starting to say some insane things. Like, I know he like puts down the quote, like, enjoy your loss to the Saints. Did that damn near happen? You got pretty damn lucky there going down the stretch there against the Saints.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like you're beating the snot out of people. And on top of that, you're right. We probably won't play you in the playoffs because, look, you guys are going to lose before we ever see you in the playoffs. That's how that's going to happen. It's just the way it is. And it's cool that he got to have 1 week to really feel good. But, you know, the day of reckoning's coming. And it looks a lot like week 17.
Jason, your team gave up 46 points. Your defense gave up 46 points this last weekend. How would you be so high on your horse after that?
I don't know, but he is. And like I said, oxygen's getting super thin up there.
Have the Seahawks even given up 46 points to a team this season?
No.
I don't think so.
No.
That's a lot of points.
And they got pushed around by the Ravens, too, by the way.
The 49ers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Their defense allowed more points to the Ravens than the Seahawks defense allowed points to that Ravens offense.
And our defense is mediocre. Like, it's not, that's not supposedly the strength of the team. So,
no.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just fun.
And I've seen this whole thing about 49ers fans knocking Russell Wilson's season just because Jimmy G had four good weeks over this last stretch.
Well, and good for Jimmy G. Like, I will enjoy having at least one quarterback in the division that can rival ours. Like, that would be nice. It add to, you know, the competitive fire of the division. I could take that. We'll see how long that lasts for Jimmy. I have less faith in the sustainability of Jimmy G than I do in the sustainability of Lamar Jackson. Let me put it to you that way.
Oh, I think Lamar Jackson's sustainable.
Yeah, if I'm going to, because everybody, the big worry about Lamar, right, is his sustainability going forward.
Yeah, he's not Robert Griffin.
But he's also not Russell Wilson either.
Like, oh, yeah.
He's somewhere in between there. And sure, there's a legit worry to that. And so I think it's a valid concern, but it doesn't, like, if I'm a Ravens fan, it's like, yeah, he might get hurt, but honestly, like, let's go. Like, this is fun. And I think he has the ability to put it together for, you know, 2-3 years like that pretty easy and then transition his game if he wants to. I would have more worry about Jimmy G being sustainable because it's been clear that he needs all the parts around him to work like clockwork for him to have success. And they're not going to be able to keep that up. It's just not the way it works in the NFL. Like, once you start to get good, you start losing dudes through attrition, whether it's injury or they get picked off by other teams and things of that nature. And look, I mean, Kyle Shanahan isn't going to be able to scheme his whole career to, you know, greatness.
Yeah.
So I worry about his sustainability more than Lamar's. So enjoy Handsome Jimmy for now, Jason. It's good for your deal. And congrats for the moment.
Yes, you do have the most handsome quarterback in the division. We will give you that.
Yeah. I don't know.
Whatever. He's the most handsome quarterback in the NFL, so you have to give it to him in the division.
In the NFL?
Name me a more handsome quarterback than Jimmy Garoppolo.
Fitzpatrick.
Well, he's a rugged handsome for sure. He's Montana handsome.
Yeah. He looks like he could wrestle a cougar with his bare hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
1A,
Jimmy
1B.
Jimmy G looks like he catfished his pants if he saw a mountain lion in the wild.
And if that plays into your definition of handsome, then I think that's fair. And I'm not going to I'm not gonna argue with you.
It does to me. I don't know.
I believe you. All right. I ought to do better and better at life, but I wanted to take this time for this segment. I do have a better at life, but I want to
Is this just going to be our combined do better and better at life here? Like what we're bringing up right now? Okay. All right.
I wanted to get into this controversy with the Patriots because it's back. And it's back, and it's thanks to some anonymous Bengals scout. But so just to give everybody an idea of the backstory, if they haven't heard about it yet to this point, this past weekend, the Patriots, they sent a 3-person crew to the Bengals and Browns game. And it was part of a feature story that the Patriots were doing on their scouting department. You know, they do those features for their websites and just to give you an idea of what people do on the staff. And in this case, it was a Patriots pro personnel scout while he was working in the press box, which is the place where pro personnel scouts do their work.
Right.
So what happened was the Patriots went and asked permission to the Browns to have this camera crew there, to have the scout there, and the Browns granted permission. What they didn't do was they didn't tell the Cincinnati Bengals that this was happening. And apparently that's part of the issue, because in the quote that came out afterward from the Patriots organization, it says, "While we sought and were granted credentialed access from the Cleveland Browns for the video crew, our failure to inform the Bengals and the league was an unintended oversight." And I'm sure a lot of people are saying, oh, yeah, right. In addition to filming the scout, the production crew, without specific knowledge of league rules, inappropriately filmed the field from the press box. The sole purpose of the filming was to provide an illustration of an advanced scout at work on the road. There was no intention of using the footage for any other purpose. We understand and acknowledge that our video crew, which included independent contractors who shot the video, unknowingly violated a league policy by filming the field and sideline from the press box. When questioned, the crew immediately turned over all footage to the league and cooperated fully. The production crew is independent of our football operation. While aware that one of the scouts was being profiled for a Do Your Job episode, our football staff had no other involvement whatsoever in the planning, filming, or creative decisions made during the production of these features. We accept full responsibility of the actions of our production crew at the Browns-Bengals game.
Oh, am I supposed to wake up now?
are you buying this? Does this seem like, because I think with the history of Spygate, people look at this and they go, okay, maybe this is the Patriots at their hijinks all over again.
Yeah, well, we didn't go to the moon and the Earth is flat. And I just read today that the Titanic really didn't sink. It was a dummy ship that White Star Line put out there, too. Like, this is, do I believe the Patriots statement? Yeah. Yeah, I do. Let me tell you why. For a few reasons. Number one, they asked permission of the team, the Browns, that was playing at home, if they could film in their home. Number one. Okay. So they asked for, like, telling the Browns, we are going to be in your stadium running video cameras. This is what we intend to film. Yeah. Okay. All right. So if they're so nefarious, don't you think they have some dude with, like, in a regular Joe, you know, maybe in a Browns coat with a little secret hidden camera under the lapel, like filming the sidelines, like for them to be like, oh yeah, no, we're coming. Like that doesn't point to being secretive. Like, number one. Number two, no, they didn't tell the Bengals because they had no intention of filming the catfish Bengals. Okay. Like, they just didn't. They're there to do a profile on pro personnel scouting, like, which is guys who go to other professional teams games and watch their players from the press box. Thirdly, they hired independent contractors to do this. You know, as an independent contractor in the filmmaking industry of whatever kind, like if you're in that kind of, you know, space, you get called to do all sorts of kind of jobs. Maybe these guys were filming stuff for a perfume commercial the week before. Do you think they know the exact ins and outs of all of the league rules? I sincerely catfish doubt it. On top of all of that, the second they were questioned about this, they go, oh, that was a problem? Here's all the crap. Here's what we did. Like, it's not like they're trying to hide anything. And on top of all of that, do you think the New England Patriots need any sort of extra advantage against either the Browns or the Cincinnati Bengals? I think not. Exhibit A, the last 15 catfish years. So get over yourself, league. Get over yourself, all of you Patriot haters and conspiracy theorists. This isn't a big deal, and it pisses me off. I even had to waste a moment of my life thinking about this one more time.
All right. Well, Adam gave you his side. I'm going to give you my more reasoned side of looking at this, because I don't doubt that there is, and the reports are that there's 8 minutes of sideline footage of the Bengals signal callers. And I think there's a perfectly rational explanation for it, because I was kind of curious, what do pro personnel scouts and advanced scouts do? Well, they go to the game and they spy on the other team. That's what they do. That's part of their job. And it's what all the other teams do. I went and I looked this up. There is an article from Jeremy Green on ESPN from 2007, after the first Spygate incident. The title of the article: Advanced Scouting Makes Spying Unnecessary. And here's some of the quotes from this story. He says, in my 5 years working in pro personnel with the Cleveland Browns, one of my jobs was to scout upcoming opponents and create that advanced scouting report. So while the Browns would be preparing to play, say, the Bengals — it's kind of curious that it was an article where he mentions the Bengals in this article, and it's part of the controversy here — he says, I would be looking ahead to the next week's game against Pittsburgh. I would study the film of the Steelers, looking for formations, tendencies, and anything that might help formulate a game plan. On Sunday, while the Browns were in Cincinnati, I would be in the press box in Pittsburgh. This is a common practice, and league bylaws actually state that no team shall prevent a member of an upcoming opponent from attending the game in that capacity. I used a pair of binoculars and prepared sheets to chart what I saw. I would look at the formation caller for the upcoming opponent. Most every team has an offensive coach who stands on the sideline and sends in personnel groupings. and he is usually easy to find because he'll wear a different colored shirt or a backwards cap or some other distinguishing characteristic. This allows the offensive huddle to recognize him amidst the chaos of an NFL sideline on game day. It was my job to chart what signals he gave and which players came in and out of the game. Is it a 3 or 4 wide receiver package? Is it a short yardage package? Talks about the packages here. This is very valuable to a defensive coaching staff because the quicker they can determine what the offense is doing, the sooner they can adjust to getting the personnel to get the extra defensive back or defensive lineman into the game. So listening to all this, it explains essentially what a personnel scout does. And if they're videotaping, if this is what a scout is looking for on the sideline, as a videographer, aren't you going to ask the dude, oh, hey, what are you looking at right now? What are you trying, what information are you trying to get? Oh, I'm looking at this dude down here that's calling in the signals from the sideline. And they're going, oh, because they're a camera crew. Oh, I want to get some footage of that because this is what he's actually looking at. So to be able to show what he's looking at, this is what I would film.
Yeah, no, and that makes perfect sense. And I think that buttresses into exactly what I said in the idea that these guys don't know the catfish rules. They don't. Like, this videographer, like, he probably did a wedding the weekend before, okay? And so, like, for him, just like you said, he's like, oh, so what are you doing? I'm looking at that dude. Okay, cool. We're doing a feature on such things. I'll film a little bit of that.
Yeah.
But instead, we get to have a whole nother national crisis, and people get up in arms and lose their crap that the Patriots are the Cheatriots and all that stupid shit.
Catfish!
It's exhausting.
But it was just... I don't think most people know this part of the game. I don't think that they know that they have a person that goes and scouts the team a week ahead of the game and essentially tries to get an idea of what their signals are. He talks about how, after you watch a team a few times, the scouting gets easier. And because teams generally don't switch out their personnel grouping signals, said he tracked Pittsburgh for 5 years and their signals were the same the entire time. Same for Baltimore, obviously being in that division. Said teams that run the West Coast offense, the Seahawks, Eagles, Packers at the time, all similar as well. So
you're telling me that these teams who have their own dudes that go out, like Seahawks, Packers, Steelers, all these guys, right? These teams that have their own dudes that go out and do their own little, advanced scouting / spying, right, in the stands, know this is happening. And since they know that's happening, you would think if it was important, they would then change up their signals and all that stuff. But because it's not that damn important, it doesn't give you any, much of an advantage at all, if any. They don't care, so they don't even bother to change all that stuff.
The article does say there's a slight advantage. That's why New England filming the opposing coaches is mind-boggling to me, because there's not a lot left uncovered by advanced scouting. And what's not there can often be found in films shot during the games. He goes on to say there are certain things you can pick up if you know the language, but not all pro personnel people speak it fluently. For instance, I once scouted a Rams-Panthers game and saw the St. Louis defensive signal caller twice hold up two fingers and then roll his hands like he was rolling dough. I took this to mean that they were in a cover two role with the ball going to wide receiver Steve Smith's side. But I could not really confirm that because after the snap of the ball, I had to move the binoculars to see the entire play. Plus, I only played as far as high school, and even as a son of an NFL coach who spent his entire life around the game, it was nearly impossible to consistently pick up which signals dictate certain blitz or coverage packages. But remember, some coaches don't change signals very often, if at all, so maybe the Patriots thought picking up signals would help them in future games. And he's talking about Spygate here. So if you were recording video, it's a little bit different than watching with binoculars because you can maybe sync things up a little bit better,
I guess.
So,
yeah.
But he's saying it's like a 5% advantage,
if that.
Right.
So cool. I should be outraged. This does feel like a symptom of outrage culture. It does.
I wanted to know myself if I should be outraged about this, and I came across this article from a former pro personnel scout after the Spygate scandal. And this makes me think that I probably shouldn't be outraged about it.
Well, yeah, exactly. It turned out that I was just as outraged about this story as I was about the Peloton commercial.
You weren't outraged by that?
Turns out, no. Because I took it for what it was,
for a buck.
Like a person.
No, we have to read into everything and not only read into everything, but read into it in the worst possible way, and then frame it in that worst possible way to all the other people on the internet to get people outraged about it.
Right. And to signal that you're on the right side of history to all of your fellow, you know, whatevers, followers. This doesn't make any sense.
I don't know what the right side of history for a Peloton ad is.
Oh, well, I mean, the outrage, right, was like it was something to have to do with the patriarchy and, like, you know, the husband thinks she's too fat and so buys her a bike for Christmas. And I don't know.
It does have me questioning myself, though, because my wife asked me for a rowing machine for Christmas. I don't think I can get it for her now.
Why?
All the assumptions that are made with the Peloton commercial. I don't want to be assumed that I'm just listening to what my wife wants and getting her the present she wants.
If you're being encouraged to buy a rowing machine by your wife, I would say do it. And it has nothing to do with her. Rowing machines are cool. I like using the rowing machine. I don't have one. I'd like to have one in my house.
Yeah.
And I would definitely buy that as a gift for her. That's for me.
Okay.
See what I'm saying?
You want to come over and use it too?
Well, yeah, if you weren't 2 hours away, if you hadn't moved away and abandoned me in Missoula, like, then yeah, I could.
Come over and row together.
Yeah.
Well, see, it's things like this that just have me second guessing myself, and I don't like it.
No, Brandon, why would this have you second guessing yourself? Like, look at it and be like, is that stupid or not stupid? And then you're like, oh, that's stupid. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to worry about it no more. It really cleans up life for you. It's real easy.
It does clean things up easily.
Yeah.
One person who is not stupid and is really, really awesome, in fact, are better at life this week. Mr. Walter Jones.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's Walter Jones, number one. What else did he do? Did he brush? How else did he brush us all with his greatness? I don't know.
Can I talk about him every week like I talk about DK Metcalf every week? Or are you going to admonish me for this?
Guess what? Walter Jones, maybe the greatest left tackle of all time, if not in the conversation, Hall of Famer, Ring of Honor. I feel like he's earned the right to be talked about every week.
Okay.
And DK Metcalf is having a nice rookie season. See the difference?
Well, Walter Jones doesn't want you bringing up his name. He's asking for the favorite four Seahawks of all time from all Seahawks fans. He's out interacting with Seahawks fans on Twitter. He's actually apparently very much into Seahawks Twitter for some reason. He was talking about all the Twitter people who have really bad food takes out there and kind of getting after him on that. But this was kind of cool. He wanted to hear from people who their top four favorite Seahawks were of all time. He's going to give a prize away to the person he thought had the right answer. And there's another reason that Walter Jones is better at life. But I wanted to get into this because I'm curious to know who your four top favorite Seahawks are. Not Walter Jones, because he explicitly said, don't name him in your top four. I'll start with Walter and what he said. He said Largent, Cortez Kennedy, Lofa Tatupu, and Matt Hasselbeck. Those were his four.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
I'll put Largent on there as one of my four. Mm-hmm. Had the Blue Angel poster. Chris Warren, another one. I have pages and pages of Chris Warren football cards still. Cliff Averill, who I've talked about plenty of times on the show, is one of my current favorites. And then Tyler Lockett.
Yeah, okay. If I had to do this off the top of my head quickly, that's trying to
give you some time. I gave you Waltz. I gave you mine.
Yeah, I know. That's cool. I'm going to work backwards. I would put Russ and Cam are up there for me.
Okay.
And then from that point, I'm looking at maybe some previous iterations of the Seahawks. You know, I'm going to put Dave Craig on the list only because I remember watching some Seahawks games with Dad and Craig at quarterback, and just some of the more exciting highs that you've had as a Seahawks fan. You never knew which Dave Craig you're getting. If you got hot Craig, man, it was a lot of fun. And so I put him on my list because of what that means watching football with my dad.
Yeah.
And then I think the final one would have to be Tez.
Cool.
Cortez Kennedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I loved Largent, like, don't get me wrong, and Jim Zorn, and
it was hard to leave dudes off my list too, because obviously Will Disley, you know, I would love to put him on my list too.
Yeah, he's got a few years to put in yet, and maybe make it through a whole season. Yeah,
not having Russ, or, you know, not really having any quarterback on my list, that was hard to do because Yeah, Dave Craig was my quarterback going up. Russ is my quarterback now. Matt Hasselbeck, awesome quarterback.
I love me some Hasselbeck too. So yeah, it was tough.
So we got our list. Walt has his list. And Walter Jones, about to be a part of an even bigger list. He was announced as a finalist for the top 100 players on the offensive line. And he might be our best shot of getting somebody into that top 100 among the offensive linemen. If he doesn't make it, if we're here on Friday and Walter Jones hasn't been one of the 7 all-time tackles selected in the NFL, I think we need to find a place to riot.
So have you watched any of these top 100 NFL player episodes? Have you watched any of them?
I haven't watched any of the episodes, no.
Okay, so I followed it to see
who has come out.
I was fired up about it. Like, I watched the first one, the running backs one, right? I was like, oh my God, like, Jim Brown's going to be on there, Barry Sanders, and, you know, Emmitt Smith, fine. and they were going to have, they had Belichick and Collinsworth, and like, I was like, this is going to be cool. Like, I'm really interested, especially with Belichick. Man, I was like, maybe this is where he gets excited and candid, because that's usually when you get the best sound bites out of Bill, is when he's talking about the NFL of the past and great players and things like that.
He knows NFL history really, really well.
Yeah, I thought this was going to be really cool. And like, so I watched it, and it was like I was watching the Masters.
Oh, really?
Or a funeral. You know how, like, every time you watch the Masters, out of all the golf tournaments, it feels like the most depressing, somber thing that's ever happened.
Okay.
The music, the production value, Jim Nantz, like the whole thing, right? Like, they're whispering about each putt like the golfer's about to die. You know, like, it's just, and that's a little bit how it felt. And it was underwhelming. And so I haven't watched anymore. But, you know, the list is a kind of a fun exercise. I mean, the NBA did it when it came their time. And, they did it with their 50 greatest players, right? And this top 100 thing is fun for the NFL. So it's another list.
I can see how this would not be exciting for, you know, fans of current football, because really there's not a lot of current players making the list. I mean, Adam Vinatieri is one guy, but he's been in the league so long, he deserves to be there too, just with all the game-winning kicks that he's made.
This last decade.
Bill Belichick on the list for coaches, which makes sense considering what he's done. But none of the wide receivers, none of the linebackers, none of the running backs, not current players.
Sure, I guess if you're a very young fan, that'd be tough if you didn't grow up watching the game. I mean, I can remember a lot of players from the 80s and 90s, right? And so when I see them up on the list, I mean, they're people I know. And then there's, you know, guys of older generations that I definitely have heard of or even seen highlights of and know their place in history. Like, you know, I mean, obviously Jim Brown, but like Marion Motley, like that was a guy who was on my radar. That's somebody I knew and I felt like belonged on the list. So, yeah, I think there's value in seeing a lot of the older players and knowing where the game evolved from. I enjoyed that part of it. I just wish that they would have done it with some lightheartedness and some fun rather than, you know, acting like this was a funeral parlor.
So there's 40 guys that the NFL came out with announcing as finalists for the whole offensive line. They select 18, 7 tackles, 7 guards, and 4 centers. And so we're going to find that out Friday. Walter Jones has to make it, right?
Yeah, I'd be surprised if he didn't.
There's some pretty big names on this list. You have Joe Thomas. You have Art Shell. You have
Art Shell would be one for me.
Willie Rofe.
Anthony Munoz. God, I can never say his name. The dude that played for the Bengals. Yeah,
Anthony Munoz.
I don't know why that's a hard word for me, his last name. He'd be up there for me. Orlando Pace would be up there for me.
Yeah, you can pretty much name off the guys that the current guys, right, that you would expect to be on there. You didn't mention Jonathan Ogden.
Yeah, okay. I could see that.
He's up there. If Ogden makes it in over Walter Jones, then I'd be upset. But then there's other guys that, I mean, I don't know, Bob the Boomer Brown, Roosevelt Brown, Lou Kriegmer.
I have heard of Roosevelt Brown.
I've heard of Dan Dierdorf just because he announced for so long.
Yeah, and he was a very good left tackle. I mean, I think
Hall
he
of
was
Fame
a
left tackle. Yeah.
Yeah, first ballot Hall of Famer, if I'm correct, but also labored in obscurity in the Cardinals organization.
So, yeah. Yeah. Forrest Gregg.
Yep, I've heard of Forrest Gregg. Yeah. He played for the Packers.
Right, yeah.
He would be one for me. That's a dude, having watched some film on him in the past and some commentary I'm in the past, like that whole Packer sweep that they're just so famous for. You all can hear Lombardi in your head right now. You get a seal here and you get a seal here and you run it right down the middle. Yeah. You know? And the whole key to all of that was what Forrest Gregg could do at tackle and the way that he could pull and just maul dudes. Forrest Gregg would definitely be one for me.
All right. Well, there's a couple other names on the list too. Bob St. Clair, Ron Yari, Ron Mix, a couple of Rons.
Yeah. Best tackle of the 2000s, the aughts. Who is that to you? I mean, because it's either Ogden, Pace, or Jones, right?
Yeah, because Rofe was, he kind of straddled.
And as much as I like Willie Rofe, and I think he's an amazing player, I don't put him on the same level as those three guys.
Yeah, I don't. I think Joe Thomas probably would maybe deserve to be.
I don't see it, but that's okay.
I'm thinking just on that same level. Yeah, so Pace, Ogden, Jones, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's your best guy out of that? Because you're probably going to get one.
Oh, I would absolutely give it to Jones. I don't need to hesitate on this.
To me, it comes down to Pace and Jones. And the one thing that I wonder if it plays into it is that Orlando Pace got a ring and Walter didn't. Ugh. I think Walter was the more dominant of the two players in their era. And that's saying something because Orlando Pace was very dominant. But just think about it. Like, there were three tackles of that ilk in the 2000s. And now here we are wrapping up the 2010s. And there's not one guy in the league that is on that level. It's just weird.
Who would be the one dominant dude from this current era right now?
I think Joe Thomas is your closest one, and he didn't play the whole decade.
Right. He played from 2007 to 2017, so it's not really a long career either.
No.
I guess you look at the tackle from Dallas.
Tyron Smith?
Maybe.
Very talented. His peak play is on the level with those guys. But he hasn't come close to sustaining. He hasn't been that guy for about 2 years now.
Well, that's
true. He had one great season.
Yeah.
And he's a pretty damn good left tackle, but he's not on that level. Like, there's just not a dude in this last 10
years. Including tackles, you could go right tackle. Lane Johnson has a pretty solid, sustained.
He's not on that level either.
So I think you might be right on this, Adam. I'm looking it up right now. The active all-pro selections right now, because if you're looking at guys for the Hall of Fame, you want to look at their all-pro selection numbers for just
usually
over the years.
Usually helps you narrow it down. Yeah.
It helps you narrow it down.
Yeah.
And looking at this list, the top two active guys right now with all-pros, J.J. Watt, Luke Kuechly, they aren't tackles. And then when I go down the list looking for offensive linemen, Zach Martin with three all-pro nods. He's a guard.
Yep.
There's not a single tackle on here.
No.
And that's looking at guys with at least three.
One
guard.
It's just weird. I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. Maybe the next 10 years we'll have another influx of very talented offensive linemen, because it seems to always go cyclically, right?
Well, a lot of these guys are defensive linemen. You know, J.J. Watt on this list, obviously Aaron Donald with four all-pros. You got Ndamukong Suh on this list with three all-pro nods, Von Miller, Khalil Mack. Yeah.
So a lot of those defenders that you're talking about, I mean, they have the type of build that they could play on offensive line. But look at what football looked like when they were growing up. I mean, we're talking defensive guys were the ones getting paid. Defensive guys were the ones making SportsCenter. You know, Ray Lewis, like guys like that. Those were the guys that were really in the forefront of the national mind. And those are the guys that got paid. And so I think that shaped a lot of it going forward, where all these guys who could have played offensive line and been very good at that, and maybe even better at that than being a defender, ended up playing on defense. And so most of the talent has ended up on the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah. And Ndamukong Suh, Aaron Donald, both $20 million guys. J.J. Watt, $20 million guy. Mm-hmm. Put those guys at left tackle, right tackle. They're not making that much money.
No. What's the top end left tackle salary? It's close to that. Isn't it around like 15?
Right now, Andrew Whitworth is the top paid left tackle at $16.6 million. And Terron Armstead for the Saints is number two at 15.8.
Okay. So yeah, we were close. Yeah. 15, 18, somewhere in there. Right.
Yeah.
And then also factor in this. how many endorsement deals do you get playing left guard in comparison to, you know, D tackle?
Yeah.
If you're really lighting it up.
I don't see a lot of Russell Okung commercials.
Yeah. Have you seen Zach Martin having a crap ton of, you know, endorsement opportunities with his 2 all pro appearances as a guard?
No. Does David Bakhtiari even get in the State Farm commercials with Aaron Rodgers?
No. They go out and they get a quarterback from another team.
It's not fair, man. It's not fair.
Offensive linemen matter.
Offensive linemen matter. Walter Jones matters. And that's why he's our better at life than Skip Bayless this week.
I like it, man. That was a fun discussion. That was much more fun than videotaping signs that don't matter.
Well, I think we maybe provided a service that you provided it in another way by, throwing a lot of 4-letter bombs about how dumb you thought it was. And I thought I provided a pretty reasonable explanation from a scout's perspective of why it's dumb.
So we both did our catfish job is what I get out of that.
And with that,
there's only one thing left to say.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks. From now on, you're not drinking a beer before the game, and I'll drink an extra one for you during the game, and we'll call it even.
This
is a good one. Yeah.